nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So the sort of the review nature of scanning telemicroscopy is completed last Thursday, and today we're actually going to start to move into scanning probes and into scanning telemicroscopy. Probably the best thing to read is that first item listed, the article by Binnig, Rohr, Gerber, and Weibel, 1982. That paper changed my life when I read it because I did not think it was possible to achieve a controllable tunnel gap in vacuum. So when I read that, I realized they had done something pretty remarkable. And so today what I'm going to do is I'm going to work up to that paper and describe to you why it's so interesting and why it was so novel in 1982 when they reported it. We're going to rely on a lot of what we have covered in the past two lectures. So I'm assuming that you believe there's a subject called quantum mechanics. Probably in 20 years, the School of Engineering will have a quantum mechanical engineering department to take advantage of what quantum mechanics allows you to do. In summary, quantum mechanics says that particles like electrons can be described as waves. When you confine these electrons into small regions of space, the energies that these electrons can have take on interesting characteristics. In particular, if you confine an electron to, let's say, a periodic array of a potential energy that is periodic in space, these electrons acquire quantized wave vectors. These quantized wave vectors tell you the energies that the electrons are allowed to have. And where we left off last week was that if you have these electrons confined, let's say, near a metal surface, what new characteristics might they pick up that would influence how electronic devices perform? And the big question in the early 1980s was to try to develop probes that would allow you to measure these electronic states at a surface with high enough spatial resolution that you could then determine whether, let's say, defects at the surface drastically influenced the nature of these electron states. So that was the problem. A lot of people were aware of that problem. One way to solve the problem is to invent this thing called a scanning tunneling microscope. So this sets up the basic idea. If you're going to probe a surface with high spatial resolution, you're going to need what's referred to as a proximal probe. Proximal probe is a fancy word for a sharp tip. And the idea is that if you bias that tip with a voltage and you position that tip a certain distance above the surface, is there anything that you can learn by studying a current that flows from the tip to the substrate? Is there anything you can learn that would tell you something about the nature of the electron states across that substrate? So that's the issue. Classically what happens is if you position that tip a few centimeters away from, let's say, the surface, and if you apply no bias voltage between the tip and the surface, then the first diagram that I've got sketched is the appropriate diagram. So what I'm plotting on this diagram is I'm plotting the energy that an electron would experience as it's located at different points between the tip, which is metallic, and that high voltage plate, which is also metallic. And if there's no bias voltage between the two, And if the metal of the tip is the same as the metal of the high vacuum or the high voltage plate, then there are work functions phi that confine the electrons to the metal tip. There's a work function phi, which happens to be equal in this case, that confines electrons to that substrate, to that high voltage plate. The electrons inside the tip, the electrons inside the high voltage plate have wave functions. They have non-uniform density of states and energy. And in particular, the gross non-uniformity of the electron states in the tip and in the substrate are indicated by those blue boxes, which means that if the energy of the electron is below or is confined to that blue box, then there is an electron present. If you go outside that blue box, no electrons exist. Okay, so that blue box is commonly used to designate the Fermi energy of electrons in metals. And the most energetic electron in a metal, which would be located right at the Fermi energy, that's confined to the metal by that work function phi. There's a barrier. The electrons just can't spill out. So nothing much happens if the bias voltage is zero. There's no current that flows. The only way you can make a current flow from the tip to the high voltage plate in zero bias is to heat the tip up and thermally excite electrons over that barrier, or to illuminate the tip with photons, shine light on it. If you shine light on it, those electrons can be photoexcited, and if an electron is photoexcited to an energy state greater than the work function of the metal tip, then in principle it could go to the high voltage plate. The situation changes if you apply a bias voltage. So as you apply a bias voltage, and if you increase the bias voltage, what you basically do is you deform that surface potential. You deform the potential barrier between the tip and the plate. And I indicate schematically what the effect of a bias is on the high voltage plate. So if you make the high voltage plate positive, you will start to pull electrons from the tip toward the plate. And the amount of electrons that you pull, the current, in other words, the current that flows, right, is going to be determined by the bias voltage that you apply. Okay? So this physics was understood long time before 1980. This is 1920s physics. And it's often referred to as field emission. And the interesting part of field emission is that all the action occurs within the first 100 angstroms or so of that metal tip. All the important physics occurs within 100 angstroms or so of that metal tip, and I indicate that here. The bottom panel, bottom two-thirds of this slide, is a blow-up of the electrostatic potential that holds electrons into the tip. It ranges over about 7 nanometers, about 70 angstroms or so. There is a surface potential barrier, which is deformed by the application of a bias voltage. That surface potential barrier has a characteristic triangular shape to it. The width of that surface barrier is indicated by this bracket on the bottom part of the slide. And what happens is if that surface barrier width becomes small enough, sufficiently small, something on the order of 2 or 3 nanometers, then it is possible for an electron wave in the metal tip to tunnel out through this barrier and escape into, let's say, the vacuum. And it does that because the electrons are now waves. They have wave functions. And if you have a wave that's confined in a potential, it's possible for that wave to tunnel through the potential. This is referred to as quantum tunneling. It's a well-known effect. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, people would conduct research on how those electrons would tunnel out. They would calculate wave functions. I give an example of a wave function that we calculated back in the early 80s, where the electron is characterized by a wave in the metal, which is on the left. The vacuum is on the right. And to get from the metal into the vacuum, the electron can tunnel at a particular energy, E, indicated by that red arrow, and escape from the metal and show up in the vacuum region as an electron. Once it's in the vacuum region, it's an electron. It's got a kinetic energy. It's a classical particle. In the process of tunneling, it's tunneling as a quantum mechanical wave. That's why these wave functions are important that we discussed last week. Ryan.
Where you said a few centimeters, you mean a few nanometers, right?
Well, that high voltage plate is typically located a few centimeters from the tip. But the physics of the problem is all confined within a few nanometers of the tip surface. It's indicated by that dash box around the tip. It turns out that's where the confining potential is located. The shape of that potential barrier that I've got indicated in this drawing is all localized within a few nanometers of that tip. After the electron tunnels through that potential barrier, it travels centimeters to the plate as a classical electron. Okay, but the physics is controlled by this quantum mechanical wave function that tunnels out of the metal tip into the vacuum. Now, the problem is, to make this experiment work, you need high voltages. You need 1,000 volt potential between the plate and the tip. Okay? And that means that when the electrons hit the metal plate, they have 1,000 volts of kinetic energy. And that's a lot of kinetic energy. It's going to cause a lot of damage to the metal plate, right? And so, although this technique is very interesting to learn about electron states at the metal tip, in other words, what are the wave functions that tunnel out through that barrier, it's not a terribly useful technique to measure what's going on at a substrate, which is, of course, what we want to know, right? We want to put a substrate down and we want to know how the electron states vary across that substrate. So this was the intellectual rut that all of us were stuck in the early 1980s. This physics was well known. It was actually known since the 1920s. But no one thought it was a useful technique to look at electron states in the metal plate that's subjected to a high voltage. What Binning and Rohrer ask, the question they ask is, what happens if you shrink the distance between the tip and the plate? What happens if you make that distance on the order of a nanometer? Okay. Now, most of us in 1980 would say you're crazy to even try to think about that, because how could you possibly stably position a tip a nanometer above a substrate? But they thought about the problem, and of course it's a very interesting problem to think about, because now the potential energy diagram that confines electrons either to the tip or to the substrate, the width of that potential energy diagram is now very small. It's a nanometer. It's about 3 atoms wide, maybe 4, maybe 5 atoms wide, right? And of course the same quantum physics is going to apply. Electrons from the tip could tunnel into the substrate if the substrate was biased positive, if there was a positive voltage applied to the substrate to pull the electrons from the tip. Except now the potential barrier that the electrons are going to go through is really small. And that changes the problem tremendously, right? That changes the problem tremendously. So the problem we're thinking about is I have a very schematic diagram. We have a blue tip, which is made of metal, doesn't look like a tip, but it is. And then we have a green substrate, which is also metallic. And we're positioning these two things about a nanometer apart. And we're going to ask, what's the current that flows from the tip to the substrate? And the current that's going to flow is going to be dictated by the shape of that potential barrier. And it's going to be dictated by the electrons in the tip and their wave functions. and how those wave functions couple to the electron wave functions in the substrate. So this problem is a problem that is solved in all introductory physics courses in quantum mechanics. So if you take Physics 550 from the physics department, probably the first week or second week of the semester, you're working out the solution to the problem of what is the transmission probability of an electron through that square potential barrier. Right? This is an analytical solution, and the gist of the solution is sketched here. You have three regions in space. You have the region on the left, which is represented by the tip. You have the region on the right, which is represented by the substrate you're probing. And then you've got this middle region. The thickness of the middle region is D, and it's characterized by a potential barrier of height V naught. You then ask the question, if I take an electron and I let that electron strike that barrier from the left, what's the probability that that electron gets to the right over into the substrate? And the way you solve that problem is you have to satisfy Schrödinger's equation everywhere. This is a one-dimensional potential well problem, so Schrödinger's equation only involves I got a mistake actually in that that slide. It should be second derivative with respect to x, not with respect to t. Okay. So because it's one-dimensional, you only have to worry about x. And the way to solve the problem is you write down guesses for the wave function. And these guesses are dictated by intuition. And the guesses that are always written down are indicated under each region of the problem. So there's a psi 1, psi 2, and psi 3. The wave function psi 1 and psi 3 have an E versus K relationship, which is free electron-like, right? The energy is proportional to K squared. So there, we pretend those are free electrons. The solution of the problem in the barrier region is an exponentially decaying wave function, and it's characterized by a parameter alpha, which I'll ask you to remember because that's going to come back in about five slides. And that parameter alpha is just nothing more than 2 times the mass of the electron divided by h bar squared times the difference between the height of the barrier and the energy E that the electron is tunneling out of, right? So that difference, that quantity V naught minus E, that's often referred to as a work function phi in the literature. So we'll be using that approximation in a few minutes. V naught minus E will be just typically the work function of the metal. How you solve this problem is you have to match the wave functions and the derivative of the wave functions at the boundaries of the barriers. And when you do that, you can calculate what the transmission probability is for an electron to go from the left to the right. Now, I write down all the arithmetic here, but we won't go through it. It turns out the transmission probability T is just proportional to the absolute value squared of this quantity D. Quantity D is the amplitude of the wave function of psi 3 in the far region of the barrier. So once you solve this problem, you get out expressions for A, B, C, D. You get out expressions for K and alpha. And it turns out the transmission through the barrier depends only on that parameter D. When you work it out, you've got this complicated equation that tells you what the transmission probability is if you tell me what V naught is, if you tell me what E is, and you tell me what D is. Right? Because from E and V naught, I can calculate alpha. From E, I can calculate K. And this quantity D, which is the width of the barrier, that's specified. Okay? So the interesting thing is that if the barrier is kind of wide, and if the energy is low, then you can approximate that complicated function by the expression on the bottom of the slide. And the expression on the bottom of the slide is just e to the minus 2 alpha times the thickness of the barrier D. Alpha is that wave number of the electron inside the barrier region. And there's some prefactors, there's some coefficients out in front. And what this tells you is that the probability that an electron goes from the left to the right depends exponentially on the thickness of that barrier. And since the probability that the electron goes from the left to the right is proportional to the current that would flow from the left to the right, if you hooked up an ammeter, right, and measured the current that flows from the tip to the substrate, you should find that the current varies exponentially if you could vary the thickness of that square barrier. Right, that's the prediction. So we all understood this. I mean, anybody that's taken these introductory physics classes understood this general principle. The question is how to experimentally achieve it, right? It's really tough to do an experiment. But theoretically, this formalism and this idea was well known. So there are some nice simulations on the web that allow you to visualize this in a little bit more detail than I can do. So I really like the University of Colorado. They have some very excellent simulations on quantum mechanics. You can look at this at home tonight if you have the inclination. But what we have is we have a barrier, right? Just to show you how it works, you have a barrier. You can adjust the width of the barrier with the slider. You can adjust the energy of the electron as it is incident onto the barrier. So the electron is coming from the left, trying to go to the right. You can plot the real part of the wave function, the imaginary part of the wave function, or psi times psi star, which is indicated by this black line at the bottom of the page. What happens is, of course, if the barrier is wide and the energy is low, not much electrons tunnel from the left to the right. And that's indicated by the fact that on the right-hand side of that barrier, the probability density of finding an electron is essentially zero. It's essentially zero. In fact, it depends exponentially on how the energy is distributed, right? So if I start to look at electrons that just cross the top of the barrier, right, Schrödinger's equation is being solved as we speak, you can see the electrons now start to tunnel through the barrier. That's indicated by the red wave function that now is on the right-hand side of the barrier. There's a probability that happens, and you can actually plot the probabilities. Let's see. So you can actually show how much of the electron is reflected, how much of it's transmitted, right? And as I get towards the top of the barrier, the transmission is going to get higher and higher, right? So now I've got a situation where when I'm just going over the top of the barrier, about 50% of the electrons are reflected, 50% of the electrons are transmitted, okay? So this type of applet kind of gives you some intuition about what's going on without having to do the calculations. The interesting thing, of course, is to shrink the width of the barrier, because as the width of the barrier shrinks, you can see that the probability that the electrons start to tunnel through that barrier, that probability starts to go up, is indicated by these numbers T on the right-hand side of the slide. Okay? Yes?
So the barrier here is the distance between the tip and the metal?
Yeah, so we have to go back and think experimentally what we're doing. And what we're saying is that if you could bring a tip close to a metal surface and have it separated by a distance d, separation of that distance d is going to be the width of that barrier. Notice the scale, the x-axis scale is in nanometers.
So why this is independent of the wave function for the electrons to go from the tip to the vacuum?
It's not. It's strongly dependent on the wave function. So effectively, what you're doing is you're varying the work function by adjusting this parameter here. So here you would have a very high work function metal. So there's a large distance from the green line to the top of the barrier. That's that's the equivalent of the work function in this problem, right? If you make the work function very small, that means this green line is up here towards the top of the barrier. When the work function is very small, then there's a high probability that the electrons tunnel. So this is a one-dimensional analogy, right, to a very complicated three-dimensional problem, which is a tip placed by a surface, but it's got all the right physics, right? It's got all the right intuition involved. So I encourage you to look at this website tonight if you like to think about electron tunneling, or if you've not had a chance to think about that in your course of study. It's one of the fundamental features of quantum mechanics that actually shows up in real-life devices, right? And so the website, right, the website is given at the top of the page. Some of you are asking me after last week's lecture, which covered a tremendous amount of material, you said, oh, is there some website I can go to learn more about quantum mechanics? And the one I like is this hyperphysics website. I give the citation, the web address on this slide. Hyperphysics is a really interesting website because it tries to show you how everything's interconnected, right? It has trees, logical trees that you can go and you can click. So you can click on quantum mechanics, and when you click on quantum mechanics, you'll see a whole tree open up with different topics that are interesting. And then depending on what topic in quantum mechanics you're interested in, you can click on the different branches of the tree, and you get short little descriptions about the particular topic of interest. So if you don't take quantum mechanics in physics and you want to learn a little bit about it, I recommend the hyperphysics website. And this provides, in my opinion, a useful summary of barrier penetration. It's got all the right words and pictures, okay? And there's lots of other topics in this. It covers all of physics. Okay, that's the simple picture. Real life is always more complicated, right? In real life, you got these two metals. Hypothetically, you can position them a distance d apart. The separation d has to be on the order of a nanometer for there to be appreciable current to flow between the two metals, the green substrate and the blue tip. But the wave functions have to be correct if you want to analyze data. Why are not the wave functions correct in these simulations that I just showed? They're not correct because those simulations rely on the free electron model. The free electron model neglects all the potential energy variations due to the atomic cores. So we discussed this at great length on Tuesday, and hopefully now you see why I discussed it, because really the potential that the electron sees as it comes close to that barrier is dominated by these strong electrostatic attractions due to the atomic cores. And those strong modulations in the bottom of the potentials indicated on both the left and the right, those are going to modify the wave functions. They're going to cause the electron wave functions to have a band structure. There's going to be certain energies that are not allowed, right? All the stuff that comes out of this Kronig-Penig model that we discussed will apply. And the question is, what do you do? Right? How do you handle that situation if you want to do more than just free electron model? And the answer is, through a simple approximation, you use the insights that you've already gained by studying the barrier penetration of a free electron. Okay, what you say is, you say, okay, the wave function that I'm going to use when the electron leaks out of the metal surface is going to be psi of z. Z is going to be measured from the metal vacuum interface. So z equals zero is going to be right at the vacuum. And we're going to say, we don't know what that wave function is, but whatever it is at z equal to zero, it's probably going to decay exponentially as it leaks out into the vacuum. And so we say that the wave functions that are appropriate are psi evaluated at the interface times an exponentially damped factor e to the minus alpha z, where alpha is the same parameter that we used before for the free electron model. It's just 2m h bar squared times the difference v naught minus e, where e is the energy of the electron state that's trying to get out of the surface, out of the tip. And then we say, well, what's the probability that we would observe that electron at some distance z from the surface of the tip? Well, probabilities are given by psi star, the magnitude of the wave function squared. So you just do some simple arithmetic, and you can find that the wave function as a distance away from the tip should be equal to the wave function at the surface of the tip times this exponential factor e to the minus 2 alpha z. And then you say we've got a barrier of width d. So the probability that we find an electron at the metal surface is the wave function of the electron in the tip at the surface of the tip, psi of 0 squared times e to the minus 2 alpha d, right, where the 2 comes from squaring e to the minus alpha z, right? So it's very similar in form to the transmission probability that we calculated earlier, right? Very similar. So now we have to make a current flow, right? That's the next thing, intellectually, conceptually. And the way you make a current flow is you have to apply a bias voltage between the substrate and the tip. In this case, the bias voltage is E delta V. What I've done is I have biased the substrate positive with respect to the tip, so it's going to pull electrons from the tip into the substrate. And there's going to be a range of energies, right, which I indicate by the gray box on the left-hand side. There's going to be a range of energies of electrons that are going to be active in producing the current that flows. So it's just the electrons indicated that lie between the two dashed red lines. The width of that, the separation between those two red lines depends on the bias voltage that I apply. And that bias voltage that I apply, I can control, right? I can turn a knob. It's a power supply voltage. Typically, the delta Vs we're going to use are going to be on the order of a half to 1 volt, not the thousands of volts that we needed when we were doing this field emission experiment that we discussed earlier. So now the voltages are small, the tunnel barriers are very short, and if you want to calculate from first principles what the current is, you basically have to sum up all the probabilities that electrons go from the left to the right. And the summation is going to involve the exact wave functions of the electrons times the fact that you're escaping from a metal tip into the vacuum. And so to take that into account, you have to multiply the probability that the electron is at the surface times this e to the minus 2 alpha d damping factor. And you have to sum that up for all the electrons that are indicated by that gray region. Okay, so conceptually, that's what you would have to do. So how do you sort things out? You sort things out by defining something called the density of states. And in particular, it's going to be the surface density of states because we're interested in electron states at the surface of the metal. And the formal definition of this surface density or this local density of states, this is the rho of z of e that we talked about a little bit on Tuesday. It's basically going to be the sum of all the wave functions squared over that energy interval epsilon divided by that epsilon energy interval, right? So it's a formal definition, and it's just basically telling you how many states you've got per electron volt of energy, right, at the surface of the tip that's going to escape and tunnel into the substrate, right? So it's a complicated function, but unfortunately, to calculate these quantities accurately, you need to know that local surface density of states. So the equation in the yellow box should look related to the summation for the current in the upper equation. The only difference is the fact that I don't have that exponentially damped factor there. But what that means is that with a little bit of algebra, I can rewrite the expression for the current flow in terms of this density of states quantity. And that's what I do on the next slide. And the bottom line is, right, you can work through the algebra. The bottom line is that when the bias voltage goes to zero, right, the current that flows is proportional to the voltage that you apply, delta V, times the density of states at the surface of the tip, times this factor e to the minus 2 alpha d, which is which describes the probability, basically, of how the electrons go from the tip through that square barrier into the substrate, right? So in scanning tunneling microscopy, what you'll find if you read the literature is you'll find that the current is proportional to the density of states at the surface. And the reason it's proportional to the density of states at the surface, I've tried to sketch out in these previous two slides, okay? So if you were wondering why we were talking about density of states last Thursday, it was because technically you need the density of states to quantitatively understand the tunnel current that flows. And that's the bottom line. That's the thing you have to remember. So lots of examples of density of states calculations in the literature. These are not one-dimensional density of states, right? These are density of states near a metal surface. They've been performed for 20, 30 years, right? The algorithms for doing these calculations are well understood. And I give a few examples from the literature that I just picked up this summer, right? The first example is the case of an aluminum 111 surface. The aluminum atoms are indicated by those white circles. And those contours around those white circles are where the charge is located, where the electronic charge is located. The electronic charge is proportional to psi times psi star. If you sum up all the quantum mechanical states of the aluminum metal, right, you'll get these contours of constant charge density. That constant charge density is related to this local density of states because it involves the square of the electron wave functions. The density of states also involves the sum of the squares of the electron wave functions. What you should take away from this picture is that the two top aluminum atoms represent the interface between the metal in the vacuum, and there are contours of constant charge density that extend beyond the aluminum cores, the aluminum atoms, they extend into the vacuum regime. And the scale of this is, right, the distance between aluminum atoms is something on the order of 3 angstroms, right? So the wave functions, the electrons, actually leak out into the vacuum by distances on the order of 3-5 angstroms. And those electrons can be coupled into by a tip that is brought in close proximity to the metal surface. And when you couple into those wave functions that exist outside the aluminum surface, then you can set up a tunnel current. And that tunnel current is going to be proportional to the density of states of the electron wave functions at the substrate. The example on the right is another example. This is the nickel 001 surface. It's again just an example I got out of the literature. Again, the thing to take away from this picture is that there is finite charge outside the metal surface, right? And that finite charge is represented by electron wave functions that have been calculated assuming the atomic cores of the nickel atoms placed in this periodic lattice as indicated in that diagram. You'll also find a lot of slab calculations of densities of states, right? So people take like 7-atom slabs, right? That's indicated in the bottom picture. and they start to look at what are the local density of states on each slab of atoms. The answer to the question for this particular calculation is shown on the right. And what you can see is, you can see that the surface density, or the local density of states on each slab, if you're on the middle slab, you've got a plot that looks like this. And as you approach the surface, as you approach the surface slab of atoms, the shape of the density of states changes, right? The shape of the surface density of states changes. And that means that if you do a bulk calculation for density of states, it may not be appropriate for the surface, right? The surface is completely different than the bulk. And so if your surface, for instance, has a layer of oxygen on it, right? The density of states for a slab of atoms that have a layer of oxygen, that surface density of states is going to be completely different than the surface density of states for a slab with no oxygen, right? So this all of a sudden gives you some insight into why this scanning tunneling microscopy is so surface sensitive, because it depends very, very carefully on density of states at the surface. Density of states at the surface can be influenced by many things: defects, atoms, right, grain boundaries, you name it. They'll all affect density of states at the surface. And of course, the great thing is, that's what STM measures, right? Just another example, right? This is a little bit more recent calculation. People can take clusters of tungsten atoms. Tips are typically made out of tungsten. So you can model a tungsten tip, in this case with 14 atoms, and then you can model a copper substrate. These authors picked either 13 or 25 copper atoms, two cases A and B. And then they can calculate density of states for these configurations self-consistently using quantum mechanical principles. And they get some very interesting diagrams. All right, next page shows you the projections of these density of states onto certain atomic orbital features that you might think are interesting in this problem. So most of the chemists in the audience know that the tungsten is a transition metal atom, and the interesting electrons in tungsten are these 5d electrons, right? It's a half-filled d shell, four electrons. So these authors actually projected the local density of states in the region between the tip and the substrate. They projected those density of states into these atomic orbitals appropriate for the d electron states, and they generate these nice pictures that have some resemblance to these hydrogenic wave functions that we talked about on day one, right? They have lobes and donut-like features that reflect back onto the character of the d states in tungsten. And of course, it's those states between the tungsten tip and the copper substrate, it's those states that are going to carry the current. And so if you want to understand the current accurately, you've got to understand in detail what those states are, right? What the shape of them are, how they're arranged in space, right? It's a complicated factor. So let's do some typical values, okay? Let's not worry about the details anymore. Let's step back, look at some typical values. So I list work functions in electron volts for half a dozen characteristic metals. You can see they typically lie between 4.5 and 5.5 electron volts. That calibrates your energy scale. I use this expression for alpha. The expression for alpha is often written in convenient units by the second line in this slide. So if you tell me the work function in electron volts, I can calculate alpha in inverse nanometers by just taking the square root of phi, multiplying it by 5.1. So I put in all the arithmetic, did all the energy, all the unit conversions. And so you get this very simple relationship. You tell me the work function, I take the square root of it, multiply by 5.1, and I have this decay factor, alpha. And so now look what happens, right? Look what happens when you actually use these numbers to evaluate alpha and to evaluate the tunnel current that would flow, right? So I just do the simple calculation, right? The tunnel current I of z is equal to the total current that would flow if the tip were in sharp, in intimate contact with the substrate. So if I literally ram the two together, that would tell me what I zero is. And then as I pull the tip away from the substrate, the tunnel current is going to decay exponentially as e to the minus 2 alpha z. What happens if I just pull the tip a tenth of a nanometer away? That's one angstrom. If I just pull the tip a tenth of a nanometer away, what you can show using these numbers is you can show that the current at a tenth of a nanometer is equal to one-tenth the current when the tip is a tenth of a nanometer closer to the substrate. Okay, so that's the bottom line in this slide, right? Just a change of one angstrom in the tip substrate separation typically will change the tunnel current by a factor of 10. Right? So it's a tremendous sensitivity to Z just by measuring tunnel currents, because anybody can measure a factor of 10 change in tunnel current. Right? You don't have to be an electrical engineer to measure a factor of 10 change in tunnel current. That's easy, right? It's either 1 or it's 0.1. Huge change, right? Huge change. The problem is, how do you achieve this controllable tunnel gap now, right? And the answer is you have to be clever about it, because if you just took a piece of metal and you positioned it a distance above a substrate, and if the substrate were rough and if the metal tip that you positioned were rough, right, you would have different gap distances as indicated by those red arrows in the top slide. In other words, the separation between the tip and the substrate could be very ill-defined unless you have a very sharp tip. And that was one of the insights that that Binning and Rohrer had, is, well, you know, let's make a sharp tip and let's hope that we've got a situation that is displayed on the bottom part of the slide rather than a situation that's displayed on the top part of the slide. If you have a situation that's displayed on the top part of the slide, it's my contention that if you try to measure the tunnel current and you try to interpret what you measure, you won't be able to do it because you won't understand the distribution of those gaps. You won't understand the length of those red arrows, right? If you don't understand those lengths, game's over, right? You can't do any quantitative modeling of your experiment. If on the other hand, right, you've got a situation as described in the bottom slide, then you're in business, because, you know, magically on the bottom part of the slide, there's one atom of the tip, right, which forms that tunnel gap. And so now the tunnel gap all of a sudden is well defined. So that gives rise to the first rule of scanning tunneling microscopy. First rule of scanning tunneling microscopy is that all good tips end with one atom, right? And if you don't have a good tip, throw it away and make another one until you get a tip that ends in one atom. Because if you don't, it's extremely difficult to do STM, right? You'll always be in that top situation, and things are very confused. So have anybody done STM in the audience here? A couple of you? So how often do you get good tips?
Probably like one in every five.
One in five? Yeah. So it's not automatic, right? You just can't make a tip and assume it's going to work. So the question is, yes, another question.
How do you systematically evaluate that?
How do you systematically evaluate the goodness of your tip? Well, you start to develop a sense of feel for it, I think. One of the classic ways to do it is to image a substrate that you know. And if you can image the substrate that you know and achieve atomic resolution, then you know your tip is good. Right? I suppose we should let the students who actually do the measurements answer the question. How do you know when your tip is good?
I look at it, usually I look at a step edge and then see if it's, it looks what like I should expect it to look. And then also if you know a sample, you know what it should look like under a good tip. If things are crazy, then chances are your tip's not good.
Robert, how do you evaluate this?
Pretty much the same way. You know, if I have an image and it doesn't look anything like I'm expecting it to, then most of the time it's usually because the tip's not good.
Yeah, so how many samples do you have to scan before you think you know what an image is supposed to look like? Can you do that the first time? Does it take a week? 2 weeks? A month? A couple months? Right? You can't. So the bottom line is you just can't go in, put the tip close to a substrate, and expect to get something in a day. Right? It just doesn't work. You have to build up some intuition about your sample. You have to build up some intuition about how to make good tips. Right? I know you have techniques to make good tips that you've told me about, right? And they've been developed.
It's been going well.
but you know, it's just like you gotta do it, right? I mean,
every day is different.
Every day is different. Another question.
To some extent, my question wasn't how do you find out if a tip is good? Question was, how do you systematically evaluate whether a tip is good, other than the sense of intuition? Is there a methodology that's something that's accepted within the community? If you
yes.
report in the journal, you say, you know, we received the following image by first evaluating the tip where we did the following.
Yeah, so there are procedures. So the top groups in the world do all these experiments in ultra-high vacuum, and they have prescribed ways to clean the tips. Some of the groups actually image the atoms on a tip using a technique called field ion microscopy. So you can actually evaluate the tip structure by looking at a field ion image of the tip, and you can pull atoms off until you get a virtuous image. But there's only maybe a half dozen groups in the world that go through that effort because it's very expensive and very time consuming. But there are annealing procedures. You can look at the electron emission current, for instance. If you do field emission, you can evaluate the total current that's coming out of your tip when a plate is a centimeter away from it. That's another way to evaluate how sharp the tip is. So there have been different techniques suggested.
As you read the literature, do you find yourself having a certain level of trust in certain data based on how they report these things? Do you find that you can look at the images that are presented and say, yeah, they had a good tip? Is that how you go about doing it?
Well, usually you just present the best images that you get, right? So there will be hundreds and hundreds. Every time you do this, every time you do STM, you get a picture. You always get a picture, right? But you only keep the good ones, right? And you say that on a good day, that's what STM is measuring, right? The really good groups that have a big infrastructure where they'll have postdocs and assistant professors all working on these million-dollar UHV machines, right? They have all kinds of techniques and methods to investigate tips, okay? So, when Professor Rahman takes over and starts talking about AFM, I want somebody in this audience to ask him about the shape of the tip. Because in AF, if you don't think we know much about the tip in STM, in AFM, it's 10 times worse, okay, in my opinion, right? Yet, all these theorists come in and they apply these very sophisticated models to interpret data, assuming that you know something about the shape of the tip. But in principle, I don't think you really do, right? I don't think you really do. So let's go back to the 1982, right? Does the tunnel current decay exponentially as you move the tip away from the substrate, right? And this is Binning and Rohrer's first important paper. And what they showed was that, yeah, if you're careful and you do this experiment on the left that I've got schematically sketched, and you then measure the tunnel current, the plot is right from their paper, right? The current is plotted along the y-axis. It's plotted on a log scale, right? On the x-axis is the displacement of the tip from the substrate. And if the current varies exponentially with distance, it should be a straight line on a semi-log plot. And so they show a half dozen curves. And sure enough, most of the curves do have this straight line shape to them over about 4 orders of magnitude in tunnel current. Right? So this was really a remarkable demonstration because it was the first instance in the history of physics that you could controllably tune a tunnel gap. Right? And to pull this experiment off, you had to believe that they could put the tip a few angstroms above a surface and that you could then controllably change the position of the tip by tenths of angstroms above the surface in order to get that data. Right, so a lot of people in 1982 did not think that was possible, but they showed it was, and that's the birth of STM right there. Right, you have to be able to demonstrate this controllable tunnel gap. The next step in STM is to realize that the tunnel current depends very strongly on tip sample separation. And I tried to indicate that with this sketch, this drawing here. If you believe all these equations that I wrote down, you can actually plot the tunnel current versus tip substrate separation. And what you find is that when the tip gets to be about 5 to 6 angstroms, about a half a nanometer above a surface, the tunnel current starts to rise because the width of the barrier between the tip and the substrate is now sufficiently small that a sufficient number of currents can start, a sufficient number of electrons can start to tunnel from the tip to the substrate. So I indicate how the exponential rise of the tunnel current might look if you could experimentally measure it. And then I indicate that, for instance, if you pick the tunnel current of, let's say, 1 nanoamp arbitrarily, right, and you use that as a set current, you say, I want to maintain a tunnel current of 1 nanoamp, how accurately am I measuring the tip-substrate separation for that set current of 1 nanoamp? And you can see because of that very sharp exponential rise, there's not a lot of tolerance in the tip-substrate separation along the x-axis that you can tolerate before you start to deviate significantly from that 1 nanoamp tunnel current. So you can start to think about having a device, an electronic device, which continually adjusts this tip-substrate separation. Electronically, it's a feedback loop to maintain this set current of 1 nanoamp. And so if the current starts to drift below a nanoamp, that means the tip is slowly drifting away from the substrate. If your electronic circuit tells it to approach the substrate until you get this 1 nanoamp, right, you can imagine that you're continuously adjusting that tip-substrate separation to maintain a 1 nanoamp tunnel current. And the good news is you can do that with an extremely high precision. You can do it to a precision of probably better than a hundredth of an angstrom, if you're really good, simply because of that sharp rise in the tunnel current with tip-substrate separation. And so shortly after Binning and Rohrer demonstrated this controllable tunnel gap, right, they realized that they had an extremely sensitive height indicator, right, by just monitoring this tunnel current and constantly adjusting it so it maintained a fixed value. What value it maintains, that's up to the experimentalist. You could set the tunnel current equal to a tenth of a nanoamp or 3 nanoamp, right? It doesn't matter. The whole curve is exponential, right? No matter what value of set current that you choose, with a well-tuned feedback loop, you can maintain the tunnel current constant at a particular value. And that was the key insight that led to the idea that not only is this controllable tunnel gap interesting physics, but it's also a microscope, right? It's also a microscope because it allows you to measure variations in the corrugation, let's say, in the surface of a substrate. So I try to indicate that here, right? I've got a tip. It's attached to some scanner, which I just indicate X, Y, and Z. Let's say you position that tip about 6 angstroms above a substrate. The tunnel current that you measure at that particular point is equal to the bias voltage that you apply between the tip and the substrate. That's delta V. And it's also proportional to the density of states, right? The local density of states at that particular position. And as you move that tip in a controllable way along the substrate, so we say we raster the tip across the substrate, the raster direction is indicated by those dashed red lines. As long as the density of states remains constant, and as long as you've got a good feedback loop, you will maintain a constant tunnel current. And so the values of Z that you measure, the values of Z that you measure will then accurately reflect the topography of the surface over which you are scanning the tip, right? And so, for instance, what happens when the tip falls off one of these step edges? Well, as soon as the tip falls off the step edge, the separation between the tip and the substrate increases dramatically. Step edges are on the order of 3 angstroms in most metals, right? And so all of a sudden, you go from a tip-substrate separation of 6 angstroms to a tip-substrate separation of, let's say, 9 angstroms. That change in the tip-substrate interaction, as tip-substrate separation, will cause a dramatic decrease in the tunnel current, and then your feedback loop has to tell the equipment, move the tip closer to the substrate, and the tip is driven closer to the substrate until this set current is returned, this, let's say, 1 nanoamp set tunnel current. And so it's that mechanism that allows you to map out the topography of the surface with the precision that is a fraction of an angstrom, right? And in 1982, that was unbelievable. The fact that you could first raster over a substrate and start to identify defects, step edges, dislocations, whatever. And then secondly, that you could do it with this type of precision was really remarkable. And the third feature that made this really interesting was it was inexpensive, right? If you understood what you were doing, you could build a scanning tunneling microscope for under $10,000, right? So you didn't have to go spend millions of dollars to buy the electron microscopes that a lot of you use today, right? In a couple of months, with a simple feedback loop and a battery, literally a DC battery, you could set these experiments up and start to see features on a surface that you could only imagine a few years before. So that's the microscope part of it. So to anticipate next Thursday's lecture, next Thursday I will tell you how to build a scanning tunneling microscope. I'll tell you the steps that you have to take and some of the problems that you encounter if you try to do this. I'll just point out there are two ways of thinking about how to scan a substrate. One way is called a constant tip height, tip path. Actually, it's technically not a constant tip height, it's a constant tip path. That's indicated by the dashed line on the upper part of this diagram. You can see a hypothetical sample underneath the position of the tip. The hypothetical sample has ups and downs associated. It's got topography associated with it. And as the tip scans along that constant path, right? The tunnel current will vary depending on the tip substrate separation. So by measuring the fluctuations in the tunnel current, which is indicated in the top line of that upper panel, right? By measuring the variations in the tunnel current, you are actually mapping back and learning something about variations in the topography of the substrate. And again, the reason this works is because of that exponential e to the minus 2 alpha d factor, right? If you change that gap between the tip and the substrate by a tenth of a nanometer, one angstrom, the tunnel current changes by a factor of 10. And so there's a huge amplification, huge magnification of tunnel current with topography. So this constant tip path is one way to take data, one way to scan. The second way to take data, and the data that's the way that's preferred by most scanning tunneling microscope users, is to operate the system in a constant current mode. In this case, you've got a feedback loop. You've got an electronic circuit that is constantly adjusting the tip position to maintain the tip substrate current constant. That's indicated by the tunnel current being a straight line, a horizontal straight line. And in order to maintain that tunnel current constant, you've got to constantly be adjusting the tip to maintain a constant tip substrate separation. That's indicated in the bottom part of the panel there by that dashed line. So by monitoring the ups and downs of the probe tip as it scans across the substrate, you also recover a quantitative map of the surface. Okay. So these are the two modes of scanning. By far, I think the most preferred one is the bottom, the constant feedback mode. And what we'll do on Thursday is we'll describe experimentally a lot of the features of a scanning tunneling microscope. The reason I go through this is because when you do AFM, all the features of an STM are mapped into an AFM with just a few minor changes. So to understand how an AFM works, it's probably easier to first understand how an STM works. Okay? So we're going to talk about how to build a microscope on Thursday. Next week, I'll do a transition lecture. So I'll go from STM to AFM. I'll try to provide some historical background on why people wanted to move from an STM, why people needed something called an AFM. Right? So there'll be a transition lecture, and then I'm going to turn it over to Professor Rahman, and he'll start talking about cantilevers and AFM for a couple of weeks. So that's the plan. Okay? If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. We're done a little early today, so we'll see you on Thursday. Okay? We'll build an STM.